Jay Novak is an actor in The Office. He's been a stand-up comic. He went to Harvard, where he was a member of the Harvard Lampoon and the Hasty Pudding Club. Now B.J. Novak has published a volume of short stories, short paragraphs, and some jokes. It's called One More Thing, Stories and Other Stories. Some have already appeared in The New Yorker and in Playboy magazine. B.J., thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me on.
I want to give people a flavor of the book. Could you do a short reading for us?
Sure. Here's one of the, as you said, there are very different lengths in the book. So here's one of the very short ones on the abstract and brief side. This is The Vague Restaurant Critic. More satisfying than a candy bar, but less satisfying than love, wrote the vague restaurant critic in his debut review. This is not helpful at all, murmured his readers to themselves, meaning no harm as they went elsewhere to find information more like what they had been looking for. Before the vague restaurant critic could write a second review, he was fired. A couple of weeks more and he might have caught on. He might have developed a following beyond the world of the traditional restaurant review readers for what he was doing, for the statement he was trying to make about criticism, about restaurants, about our expectations in life on a larger level. But he was fired before any of that could happen. If it was even going to happen, he didn't care. He knew what he did. But he did kind of care. He wished other people knew what he did, too. That's all.
B.J. Novak reading one of the things from One More Thing, his collection of stories.
And most are well, they're all very different. Some are much more traditional in the short story format, but I wanted some to be sort of an abstract piece that maybe makes you laugh, but also hopefully stays with you as a metaphor for other things that you notice in your life. That's the kind of piece I wanted to write, too.
It's your first book.
My first book.
How long have you been taking to write it?
Well, I wrote the book in a very concentrated year of writing, but I think the ideas had been in the works for a very long time. I was working on The Office as a writer for 8 years, and that was a time where there were so many ideas that I could put in these characters' mouths and so many that I couldn't, because the world of The Office is very specific. It's a single paper company, mostly in a single room. So while I could put romantic thoughts sometimes for Jim and Pam, or foolish notions for Steve Carell's character, there were a lot of ideas that I was in love with that I had nothing I could do with, and they became the basis for the book.
All right, I'll tell you my favorite.
Please.
Sophia, it's kind of the opposite of this new film, Her, about a guy who falls in love with an operating system that sounds exactly like Scarlett Johansson. Sophia is a sex robot who falls in love with the narrator of your story and immediately dumps her. What were you going for with that story?
Well, thank you for saying that. It's one of my favorites, too, and it's sort of the flip side of what I just read. It's a very involved, more traditional narrative. That story started, I didn't know where that was going to take me originally. That started with a joke that I had in my notebooks years ago, which was first artificial intelligence to feel love falls in love with someone who doesn't want commitment. Then I wrote Gary Shandling, ? I thought maybe it'd be a short film. And when I saw that later, I thought, oh, that's a great idea. I think it's a great idea. Let me test it. And as I wrote it, I realized I had a lot to say about love and heartbreak and our expectations for love and how they are thwarted by circumstance, because love is idealized before we experience it. And then it becomes something incredibly specific, which I think is also the nature of heartbreak, is that you can never replicate something specific. The more specific it is, the more impossible it is to replicate. So I think those ideas and emotions worked their way into this story that started in the first page is very funny, I think. But then it goes in much deeper directions, because I realized that was what I wanted to explore.
And it seems like it's partly a story about failure to commit. This guy can't commit.
He can't commit, and he thinks it's because he's a romantic, which is an interesting paradox I've observed as a single person in the past decade with a lot of friends like that, is that often it is the people who feel and say they're romantics who are the ones who seem to an outside observer to be the least romantic. The people that are constantly dating and hooking up and on Tinder and Facebook, these are often the people who say that they are such romantics, that they they can't find this ideal that they're looking for. I've been this person too. So there is an interesting and funny paradox to me that that people who seem like they are just players often describe themselves to themselves as well as romantics.
What's your favorite story?
In the book?
Yeah.
It changes all the time.
Yeah, what about right now?
Right now, a story called The Ambulance Driver, which is a very pleasant story on its surface, but has a real, to me, a sort of an upbeat darkness to it. It's about a guy who wants to, he's the best ambulance driver in his county, and he wants to quit and follow his dream to be a singer-songwriter. But in this case, if he follows his dream, people will die. And he's not a good singer-songwriter. And his friend is trying to tell him, maybe don't follow your dream. Maybe try to change your dream to what you're already doing.
And good at.
Yeah,
and
you're
saving
great
lives
at and saving lives. And yet we have this culture where, and we have this inner longing that tells us following your dream is always the best thing you can do. So he does follow his dream, and he's really bad, and people die. But the story kind of follows how wonderful it feels to follow his dream. And I wanted to do justice to that feeling, even as the sort of the dark undercurrent was expressed, but in a more subtle way. So that story, no one ever, I mean, there's a lot of stories in the book, and the book came out last week, but no one has mentioned that one to me yet. I'm kind of hoping someone will.
All right. As I mentioned to you, you've got The Duke of Earl from Gene Chandler in my mind, because one of the stories is about what would have been like if the real Duke of Earl came to the United States and didn't know about the song.
Right.
And it's kind of, I just really liked it a lot. What was the inspiration for that?
That was, I guess it was probably just hearing the song. I was listening to a lot of 50s music for a while and really liked that song. And I did think it also, the story, it's a short story, it's about 3 pages, but to me, that was one of the very first ones I wrote for this book. And it was, for me, a way to explore an idealized America where this 1950s sound is something that we associate with an idealized America, and politicians often seem to call back that era as sort of the Norman Rockwell perfect American ideal. And it would have seemed that way even more so to the Duke of Earl, who'd come to America, and everyone he meets is humming this tune to themselves and lighting up at meeting this guy, and he doesn't know why. And I think that also has a sweet callback to the irony, in a very gentle way, the irony underneath that 50s ideal was because we were seeing it from a very particular angle. It was not nearly that ideal to everyone alive in it. And I think the same would be true. Not everyone who meets everyone in 1962 and says, I'm the Duke of Earl, gets a great big grin. But he sees it that way, and he goes back to Earl, wherever that is, really always dreaming of America.
I've read that you road tested these short stories before a live audience. Is that right?
Yeah, I did. I read them at the UCB Theater in L.A.
I was going to say it wasn't a comedy club, because you also have done stand-up.
It's kind of in between a theater and a comedy club. The UCB Theater is a comedy theater, but the seats are arranged like a black box theater, and there's no two-drink minimum. It's not rowdy. It's kind of a more thoughtful. There's one in New York, too. It's sort of a more thoughtful comedy theater. So it was the perfect in-between.
How did you know that the stories were hitting or not hitting versus your performance of the stories?
That's a good question. Well, I'm not that good a performer, so the story is kind of, I was kind of telling the stories more naturally than maybe a more animated performer would. So I think I got a sense, but I also got a sense of when I wasn't into the story, when I was reading the story and thinking, this isn't that good. I don't believe in what I'm selling here, which I would try to avoid by reading it to my poor friends before I even read the stories, and I would cut stuff in front of them. So by the time I took it to stage, it was pretty good, but that sense is, yeah, even if I was selling it as a performer, I would know, like, I dread getting to this paragraph because I don't think I'm going to score with this paragraph. Well, why? Maybe I should cut this paragraph.
B.J. Novak is my guest, and we're talking about his book, One More Thing, Stories and Shorter Stories. This is for the fanboys. Supposedly, you're a character in the new Amazing Spider-Man 2. Is this correct? Can you verify this?
This is correct.
And you're a villain.
Well, I'm a bad guy, I think. I don't know if I reached the threshold for villain.
So you're not a despicable person, are you? Are you?
I'm a I'm a despicable person, but I think it would be exaggerating my role to call me a villain.
All right,
people. Villain I picture as the guy who steals the show. I'm not that guy.
People will not fear you, though. Are you? Are you a comic villain?
I'm not a good guy, I would say. But I wouldn't call myself a villain. You don't see enough of me, I think, to call me a villain.
Okay. I want to ask how you kind of came to your comic sensibility. Your dad wrote the Big Book of Jewish Humor. So what did you learn around the house growing up about humor?
My dad and his good friend co-edited the Big Book of Jewish Humor. So it wasn't just that they had compiled this book. It also meant that our house was filled with a library of all these great humor books that had been part of that book. And he also, with the same friend, co-edited the Big Book of New American Humor, which is less well-known but equally great. And that introduced me to things like Jack Handy's Deep Thoughts. So those Deep Thoughts books were around our house, and it really meant that the language of our house was really comedy, and that it kind of was like a language we all grew up, me and my brothers grew up speaking. So that was really a great way to have a childhood.
You got into Harvard, which must have been a big thrill when you were headed to college.
Surprise. Yeah, I wasn't so shocked that I hadn't applied, but it was a long shot. It was very exciting. So I got a very thin envelope. I was like, well, I tried.
So when BJ Novak is on his way to Harvard, is he thinking, yeah, now I want to do stand-up?
Well, I wasn't thinking stand-up, but I was thinking the Harvard Lampoon, which I knew was kind of the only place that I had heard of that was doing comedy on a college level. And I thought it sounded really cool. It had this real history to it. And, I really wanted to be cool in school, and I wasn't. I wasn't a pariah, but I wasn't one of the cool kids. And I wanted to be. I aspired to that. But I thought that the Harvard Lampoon, I thought that there was a way that comedy seemed occasionally cool, for lack of a better word. Just there was something dark and devil may care about a certain type of comedy that I think is what drew me to think, well, maybe I'm kind of funny. Maybe if I channel it that way. I saw Pulp Fiction when I was 14, and that, that image of Quentin Tarantino in a leather jacket, like that, I was like, oh, maybe I could try to do that. That might be my way to be cool. So I think that's what the Harvard Lampoon was to me. It was, I loved comedy, but I also, like every teenager, desperately wanted to be cool.
And when did you know that this would be more than something that you liked or did in college?
Well, I always thought I'd be a writer because it was what I was best at in school and I liked to do it. And my dad was a writer, so I didn't have to wonder, is this a crazy thing to do? I thought I'd struggle, but I didn't think it was crazy. So while I aspired to be a writer, I kind of realized, well, what I always get the most praise for in my English classes or among my friends is my comedy. I'm on the Harvard Lampoon. I should try to focus on that somewhat. And I loved it, but I didn't love it more than, thrillers or drama or anything. But it was what came naturally to me, and the other stuff didn't.
How did you end up doing stand-up?
I did stand-up because I got a job right out of school writing for a sitcom called Raising Dad, starring my good friend, Bob Saget. And I think the statute of limitations has expired, and I can say this was a bad show. And it was hard for me to write for something where everyone praised the fact that I had a job, because I was very young to have a sitcom job. But it was also pathetic, and no one would say that to my face. But I knew it. I knew it was pathetic, and I knew I was on this track to be a very successful writer of very lame things. And that wasn't at all the rock and roll cool writer fantasy I'd had. So as the show died, I got the idea to start doing stand-up comedy because a lot of the writers in the writer's room had done stand-up comedy, and their road stories sounded glamorous to my sheltered suburban life of, bombing in a bar in Milwaukee. I thought that sounded pretty cool. And I also thought it was a way to find my voice and get recognized for my voice. If I told a really cool joke, it wouldn't get five laughs in the writer's room before it died. Maybe someone would hear it and say, you're funny. I like your style. So it was a way for me to try to show people who I was.
And how did it work out when you first walked out on stage to be doing stand-up comedy? It sounds like a terrifying prospect for most of us.
Yeah, and it was awful. It was as bad as you could imagine. The first time I went on stage, my roommate wanted to do it too. We conned our way onto a show at a youth hostel, and the woman asked, "Have you ever done stand-up before?" And my friend, Ever Bold, said, "At parties." I don't know what that means. Who gets hired to do parties that's never done stand-up? She was like, okay. And put us both on stage toward the end, totally terrified. I was stiff as a board, told these really, really dry, deadpan jokes about September 11th. This is less than a month after September 11th.
Too soon.
It was on my mind very too soon, and not funny enough is the other thing. Too soon often means not funny enough to justify it. And everyone at the youth hostel was, you know, from another country. Very few spoke English. They were really responding more to physical comedy. and the MC got on after me and said, "Takes a lot of courage to get up here." So that was pretty awful. And then a couple months later, I got up the nerve to try again. And then I did it more seriously. And the trick then was I decided to book a show every night that week so that even if I failed on Monday, I knew I had to get up Tuesday. I didn't want to take 3 months to recover every time I did badly.
So the secret, there was no secret. You just kept doing it and improving.
Well, yeah, that's the secret. Yeah. Is don't let a bad performance be a referendum on whether or not you're going to try it.
How did that lead to your role in The Office?
After about 2 years of my dwindling savings from that 1 year as a writer and practice of doing stand-up, I was at this level where I was a stand-up. I did the clubs. I did sort of the alternative rooms, which is sort of the cool comics in the know book shows, and they put other people on it. And I was part of that. I was like having a little moment right under the radar, but that's where Hollywood people start sniffing around. Like, who is like the cool young, you know? And that I was right at that moment where people are starting to ask, and the answer was, well, this guy, BJ Novak, this guy, Aziz Ansari, you know, that right at that level where that's where a lot of the LA people get discovered. And a couple people, well, my first big break was on the show Punked as a prankster. And I played pranks on celebrities. Ashton Kutcher's people discovered me doing stand-up. And then only a few weeks later, Greg Daniels, who created The American Office, saw me at a club at the Improv and asked for a meeting based on my stand-up performance.
You had a role in The Office, but I started to notice as I watched the show more and more, wait a minute, that guy who plays that role, he's kind of sitting in the back of the office. He's taking on all these other roles mm-hmm. on the show in the credits. How did you come to – I mean, a lot of actors will direct an episode, but it seems like you went a lot further with that.
Well, that was always the goal of Greg, that he wanted a group of writer actors. And I was the first experiment that he did with that. And he told me that in the first meeting, that he'd be interested in hiring me as a writer and actor simultaneously, which I really wanted to do. And when that seemed fine schedule-wise, that, you know, as long as I signed my life over, which I was more than happy to do, I was able to do both jobs. Then Mindy Kaling came on and Paul Lieberstein, who played Toby. All three of us were full-time writer actors. And because we just knew the show so well, and everyone knew the show so well because it was a pretty small group, the writers eventually became producers, as happens on most TV shows. We started directing, which doesn't happen on most TV shows, but we were also actors, so we knew how to talk to actors. I'm often a little embarrassed when people say, "You've done so much. You're a director, you're a co-executive producer, you're a producer, you're a story editor." I mean, it was all the same thing on The Office, to be honest. We were just the people making The Office, so we called ourselves all kinds of things.
See, I saw a co-executive producer, and I thought, this guy's a performer, and he's a suit. He's
yeah.
Like an official guy.
And he's performing in a suit. So it was an easy transition to backstage.
You subsequently consulted with your friend Mindy Kaling's show, The Mindy Project. What did you learn from doing that?
I learned mostly from watching Mindy. Mindy is an extremely decisive person about her own voice. And I was a much more careful decision maker creatively before I got to see Mindy create her own show. I would debate things. I would test them. I would hem and haw and be perfectionist about a little detail. Mindy will have an instinct, and she'll know whether it's right or wrong and act on it right away and put it in an episode, hire that person, bring on that guest star, change the course of an episode. And she has a very strong voice, and she hears it very clearly to herself. So what I learned consulting on that show was, oh, wow, you have to be this decisive about your voice if you're going to be successful on this level. And you are able to do that. If you have a voice that's worth listening to, you should be able to hear it a beat earlier than everyone else. So watching her really inspired me to be more decisively trusting of my own voice. Not trusting in the, at the end of the day, I trust my voice after consulting everyone. Trust your voice from minute one.
Vijay Novak, your acting career is flourishing. This is a terrific new book that you've written. You have all this experience in television. It sounds like you could go in any number of different directions going forward in your career. Is there a performer or someone out there who you kind of think, man, I'd like to have that career based on where I am now? I'd like to go be like that person.
I think of Steve Martin sometimes as sort of a hero in that direction, because he, I don't think I'm as good as he is at all, but
play banjo.
I don't play the banjo.
Well.
He's such a good performer. I'm not as good a performer by any means, but he, even when he performs, whatever he does, you know it's Steve Martin. You know, even if he's just acting in someone else's thing, when he gets on screen, you know that's him. And when he writes, of course you know it's him. But that's what I want to do, where if you see me in Spider-Man or you see me on the Mindy Project, you think, oh, I know who that guy is. He's not just a hired gun. I know what I'm getting a little bit. And I see something in common with his writing. I really admire Steve Martin that way. I also really admire David Sedaris in that he is, everything starts from his writing, but I've attended his live shows. They're spectacular. And he really makes his live readings a performance. And he's a performer of his work. He's not just a reader of his work. And that's something I really enjoy doing. And I want to make my live performances, my live readings, shows the way he does.
Vijay Novak, thank you so much for stopping
by.
Oh,
what a great conversation. Thank you.
Appreciate it.